I was invited to go to X, which is the super secret research lab at Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google. I kind of felt like Charlie Bucket in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Like I was being invited into, you know, Willy Wonka's Emporium of Delights.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Famous Failures. I'm your host, Ozan Varol. Today's guest is Derek Thompson. Derek is a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. He writes about topics as diverse as behavioral psychology, economics, professional sports, and blockbuster films. He also hosts The Atlantic's latest podcast, Crazy/Genius. He's a weekly contributor to Here and Now, the national afternoon news show on NPR, and he appears regularly on CBS, BBC, and MSNBC. Derek has appeared on numerous lists, including both Inc. Magazine's and Forbes' 30 Under 30 and Time Magazine's 140 Best Twitter Feeds. Derek's debut book is Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. It's one of the best books that I've read this year. In this beautifully written book, Derek tackles a seemingly simple question. Why do hits become hits? Why do some songs, movies, and books become bestsellers while others fizzle out? The book really is a riveting read, whether you're in the business of creating hits or simply curious about why 50 Shades of Grey became a worldwide sensation. In the interview, Derek and I talk about Derek's personal failures in finding a job as a writer and how he ended up getting his current position at The Atlantic. What Derek learned from covering the notoriously secretive X, which is Google's moonshot factory. Derek was a handful of journalists ever allowed inside Google X. The strategies that X uses to cultivate an environment where employees actually embrace failure. Why X decided to hold an event modeled after Mexico's Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. The two big ideas from Derek's book, Hitmakers. Why writing a book is similar to organizing a massive house, and why Derek thinks learning is accumulation and understanding is elimination. There are lots of gems in this one, and I hope you enjoy the episode as much as I did. Before I turn things over to Derek, as always, if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. And recommend it to a friend. That goes a long way in spreading the word. And second, if you'd like to keep in touch with me, your host, you can sign up for the Weekly Contrarian, which is a short email that lands in your inbox every Thursday. It shares a new article that I wrote that week. It shares book recommendations, other tools, gems, an article that I may have read that week that I particularly enjoyed. Really anything that challenges conventional wisdom and helps you look at the world a little differently. You can sign up for that in one of two ways. You can text my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or you can go to my website, which is ozanvarol.com, O-Z-A-N, V as in Victor, ARol.com/newsletter, and drop your email address there. You'll also get my free ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Derek Thompson, and thank you, as always, for listening. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I want to begin with your background first. So I read online, and because the information was online, it might be incorrect, so please correct me if I'm wrong, that you had an early love of musical theater and wanted to be an actor. Is that right?
That's right. I loved singing. I loved acting. I loved performing in front of an audience. So before I became a journalist, which is a little bit like being in musical theater, in that you do perform in front of an audience, and sometimes they clap at you on Twitter, and sometimes they boo. that was the original career dream, and I settled for a life of writing rather than walking around the stage.
And what made you decide to go into writing instead?
Honestly, the only two things I ever wanted to be were an actor and a writer. And compared to trying to become an actor, trying to become a writer is extremely easy. Becoming a professional actor is unbelievably difficult, given the number of people who want to do that, the number of job opportunities that exist. I won't go into the sort of full labor economics of supply and demand for theater and movies in America, but suffice it to say that it's very difficult to live as an actor. So I essentially, being a somewhat risk-averse person, said I'll take the less risky option here and try to become a writer. I went to Northwestern, where I majored in journalism and political science while essentially just doing plays and musical theater on the side. And then when I graduated, I joined The Atlantic, and I've been there for the last decade.
I read also that you, before joining The Atlantic, you were turned down by several publications when seeking work. Is that right?
Absolutely. Every single one. I think I applied in the spring of 2008, the year that I graduated, to 20 magazines, New Republic, Time, New Yorker, The Atlantic, for another internship here. And I didn't get a single letter back. So I was despondent in March of 2008. And this obviously was a terrible time to try to break into journalism. The economy was in the middle of the Great Recession. So I didn't really know what I was going to do. I thought maybe I would, you know, try to go into marketing and go to business school. And on a lark, I applied to a different kind of internship at The Atlantic, a new thing they were doing called the Atlantic Media Fellowship, which was a little bit more like a hybrid journalism communication fellowship. And I was lucky enough to get that job. Started off as sort of a communications assistant to the chairman of the company, David Bradley, who's been an amazing mentor to me and many other people here. And in 2008, we were just starting with the website. I was starting to build it out, and there was this demand for more business and economic writing. And I remember the day, I think it was my birthday, and I remember the day that I was asked to become an economics or business writer for The Atlantic. And I'm not sure if I can should confess this now, but I turned it down, or tried to turn it down. I said, I don't know anything about business and economics. Don't hire me for this job. Don't embarrass the 150-year-old legacy of this brand by, you know, soiling its web pages with my terrible economics content. And they essentially were very nice about it. They said, do your best. And if you suck, then we'll fire you back to your old job as a communications intern. And so I did my best. I read as much as I could about, you know, the unemployment rate and the deficit and declining GDP and the housing crash and the rising oil prices that may have also contributed to the Great Recession. Gave myself the equivalent of kind of an ad hoc master's degree of sorts in modern economic debate, and just kept going at it. And then I became the business editor of The Atlantic and ended up, you know, writing a book that makes rather deep use of economic research. So it all worked out. I suppose the lesson here being that in a small way, we're all neophytes, and it can be helpful sometimes when trying to explain ideas to people, to not know too much, to not be cursed by knowledge, to sort of be aware of your ignorance. I think it can make you a smarter person. And I'm very, very lucky to have gotten the opportunity to do that for The Atlantic.
Yeah, I agree completely. Experts are often too immersed in whatever it is that they're studying that it's hard for them to zoom out and translate it in understandable language to a lay audience. Whereas someone like you, who, when you were starting out, were not an expert in whatever you were writing in, but did the research, you were probably much better positioned than an expert in the field to actually translate that to the public.
I hope so. Yeah. The way that I thought about it, or the way that I've formalized my thinking about it, is that when I started off doing this job, I might be completely ignorant of a question at 9 a.m. in the morning as I got to work. Let's say the question is, why is unemployment rising? In 2009, I might not have any idea what the answer is at 9 o'clock, but then I'll call a couple experts and I'll talk to 4, 5, 6 people across the economic spectrum and who will provide various answers that may intersect or not intersect. And then at 2 p.m., I'll start to write my piece. If I can remember what it's like to be in the 9 a.m. frame of mind, then I'll write a piece that will have a broader readership, or at least that will address more people, because I'll remember what it's like to not know the answer to these questions. And one of the hardest things about learning is remembering what ignorance felt like and remembering what the first question is. And it's an ongoing struggle to remember what the first question is as we're doing a podcast interview, as we're writing an article, as we're giving an office presentation. What's the first question? Luckily for me, you know, being totally ignorant of this discipline before I became a writer for The Atlantic, I think has made it easier for me to remember to keep that front of mind. What is the first question?
I love your reference to the 9 a.m. frame of mind as well. I think that's a really useful phrase to keep in mind. The one that I use with my students when they're writing anything, I tell them to perform a mind wipe, like the kind you see in Men in Black, to just sort of try to wipe your mind And remember that whoever's going to be reading this doesn't know nearly as much as you do in the topic that you're writing about. So one of my favorite pieces that you ever wrote for The Atlantic was Inside X, Google's Moonshot Factory. And X, and I'll let you explain what X is, but just for the audience, it's a notoriously secretive organization. And Derek was, I think, one of a handful of journalists ever allowed inside the Moonshot Factory. So I'd love to hear, Derek, your thoughts on the company, what the company does, but specifically, since the podcast is about failure, the company's approach to failure.
I was invited to go to X, which is the research lab, the super secret research lab at Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google. And as I was flying out to San Francisco to Mountain View, where the company is based, in a large, unassuming gray building, which in fact, I believe, used to be the first air-conditioned mall in California, I kind of felt like Charlie Bucket in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Like I was being invited into, Willy Wonka's Emporium of Delights to figure out what was going on behind the darkened walls and behind the gates. And I was lucky enough to talk to people working on a variety of projects, self-driving cars, drones, balloons that orient themselves around the stratosphere by catching various winds to fly over parts of the world that don't have internet access and beam internet down to them, these sort of ideas. And at any company like this, it's very, very important to figure out how do we deal with failure? Because failure is inevitable. This is not a company that's trying to take a product that already exists and refine it, right? It's not the Apple iPhone division, which has the most profitable product in the world and is trying to make it a little bit better every single year. This is a company that is explicitly trying to do things that have never been done before. And you're never, ever going to bat 1,000 if that is your goal. In fact, you're probably not going to bat 300. If you're lucky, you'll bat 100. So you want to attract really smart people to fail 90% of the time. And it requires you to have this really rigorous company culture of embracing failure. Now, embracing failure is like one of these, entrepreneurial dictums that is really easy to say and very difficult to do, right? Embrace failure, embrace failure. Yes, that's very nice. But what do you do with the hire who's a roboticist who has worked on 5 projects in the last 3 years and none of them have panned out? Right? Now, if you just go by the dictum and you say reward failure, then it sounds like what you should do is make this person like the head of the company. But in practice, it's very difficult when you don't have any evidence that they're good at their job. So what do you do? And they have a bunch of really interesting ways of thinking through this problem. One of the ways that they think about it is they talk about this problem of standing a monkey. If imagine that your job is to put a monkey on the top of a milk carton and teach it to recite Shakespeare. Now, if you are given this job and you want to show your boss that you're making progress, the first thing that you're going to do is build the milk carton or buy the milk carton and put the monkey on top of it. That's the easiest thing to do. That's the thing that tells your boss, look, I'm making progress. But what you should really do, try to teach the monkey Shakespeare first. Because it's easy to put a monkey on a box. What's hard is teaching a monkey to recite Shakespeare. So having a monkey first mentality or a Shakespeare first mentality for a company is really, really important for at a place like X. Because if this job turns out to be impossible, if it is biologically improbable to teach any ape Shakespeare, any monkey Shakespeare, then you need to abandon this project as quickly as possible and focus on something else, like teaching a dolphin to do backflips, which actually does turn out to be possible, even though it might sound equally implausible. So as a result, this is a company that is geared around trying to do very, very difficult things quickly, and then also trying to prove very quickly whether or not these difficult things are possible at all. And the way that they think about this, I thought, was just really interesting, particularly if you're in a company in a space that really is trying to do something that is relatively unprecedented. How do you adopt and how do you institute a monkey first policy?
And I mean, it's difficult from a human perspective as well too, right? So not just from the company's perspective, but if you're going into work every day and spending a year or more on a project that ends up failing and going nowhere, it might be hard to sustain the momentum or the motivation to keep on going. So did you notice any policies or any strategies that the company uses to motivate employees to keep going in the face of failure?
Let me list two things. One that's sort of a little bit vague and then one that's specific. One that's vague, but really important, is that a culture of rewarding failure is necessarily going to be invisible. But if you're surrounded by other people that are failing smart all the time, then there's less of a stigma, right? So for example, if I'm at The Atlantic and my job is to publish profiles of senators, and I'm surrounded by people whose job is also to publish profiles of senators, and they're succeeding in publishing profiles of senators, but I can't seem to get any profile off the ground in 6 months, then I'm going to feel stigmatized. And maybe rightly so, because everybody else is succeeding at their task and I'm not. But a place like X, they're not doing something as precedented as writing a profile of a politician. They're doing things that are unprecedented, trying to design self-driving cars and fly balloons around the world to deliver internet. So it helps to be at a company where all the smart people around you have a similar likelihood of success, if that makes sense. It makes it easier to not feel stigmatized, makes it easier to feel like you're surrounded by people that are trying to do something really difficult, trying to win a nearly unwinnable war rather than failing uniquely. A second thing that they do that I thought was really interesting is they adopted this idea of the Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, from Mexico, where a Puerto Rican-born woman, essentially, who I believe was the head of diversity and inclusion at the company, had this idea of creating a day where all these ex-employees could come gather around essentially the equivalent of a place where they would put these testimonials and talk about their failed experiments. Not just talk about the failed experiments, talked about failed relationships and family deaths and personal tragedies. And they would put little prototypes and family mementos on a little altar in the middle of this room and talk about essentially what their failures meant to them and what they took from them. And these sort of events are, I think, successful because they create a way to share with people in the feeling that these failures are simply steps toward a larger success, that they are acceptable. So I thought that that was a really fascinating little thing, literally having an event that celebrates failures. And then the last thing that they'll do, I know this is number three, and I only promise two, is that when a project does succeed, when, for example, the engineer for Wing, the drone project at X, succeeds in developing a bit that allows for the pincing of a string to drop and deliver a parcel to a person, sort of drop from the drone and deliver a parcel to the ground or to a front porch, the engineer will get up and talk about his success, but it's highly encouraged that he talk about all the ways that this project failed before it was successful. And here again, you have the normalization of failure and the teaching that it's okay to fall on your face over and over and over again, because those are necessary falls toward the end goal, which is to do something for the first time in human history.
Wow, there are so many gems in that answer, Derek. I particularly love the idea of the Day of the Dead. When I read this your article too, I was struck by it. And it's such a nice contrast to sort of the celebrate failure attitude in Silicon Valley, where there are literally startup like funerals, but the funerals tend to be celebrations with like DJs and bagpipes that are being held. But X held this, I mean, they embrace failure too, but the Day of the Dead signifies that failure also sucks. It's painful. It hurts when it happens. And that this is an opportunity for them to mourn their failures. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that. And I think that message gets lost in the celebrate failure, fail fast mantra that's coming out of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it is. And Silicon Valley is, well, first, let's acknowledge that it's gone through what I consider a really fascinating, vertiginous turn in terms of public perception in the last few years, where I think immediately after the Great Recession, there were so many articles that I was reading that was just like, how do we take the ingredients of Silicon Valley and sprinkle them all over America and the rest of the world? And now the prevailing attitude is much more, these guys are just old-fashioned plutocrats. They're just trying to make as much money as possible, and they're destroying privacy and democracy in the process. I think that it's fair to say that there are some companies in Silicon Valley and some divisions within some companies, individuals within those divisions, that don't have their heart in the right place, that are trying to put profit over purpose, and that are ignoring in many ways the fundamental rights of their consumers or their competitors. At the same time, Silicon Valley has lots of companies that aren't that dissimilar from X, that are really trying to do things in healthcare or robotics or mobile payments that have never been done before. And they're doing something that really could be wonderful for the future of you know, humanity. And it's really important, I think, to try to devise a playbook for failing wisely. Because whenever you're doing something for the first time, it's almost inevitable that you're going to fall on your face over and over again. And figuring out how to develop habits of both individual motivation and sort of company-wide motivation. How do we support each other, and how do we sort of support ourselves? This is really, really important. And it's why I think what X is doing is so interesting.
That actually relates to a question I had when I was reading your article, which is, to what extent it's possible to replicate the culture inside of X, outside of X. So you mentioned a number of other companies that have adopted a similar approach to failure as well. But I'd love to hear you speak a little bit more about that, because I think someone looking at X from the outside might think, well, X has the benefit of being the recipient of, you know, millions of dollars, even though, you know, they're billions. A separate organization from Google. Yeah, billions of dollars from Alphabet, Google's separate company. But what about companies that don't have that luxury? Could they also adopt this approach?
They could. Maybe not at the same scale, but they could. I think the point that you made is entirely fair. And so let's begin there. X exists because it is attached to one of the richest companies in the history of the world, probably the next trillion-dollar company. As a result, they can do things that other companies cannot. And I want to pause here to say that's important, because the history of American technological development has often relied on research and development divisions or R&D institutions that only exist because they are funded by the government or funded by a quasi-monopoly or actual monopoly. So if you take a handful of companies like DARPA, companies and institutions, DARPA, the Defense Department's Research and Development Wing, MIT, and Bell Labs, the R&D lab that was attached to Ma Bell in the 1950s, you have right there three institutions that are responsible for the building blocks of the entire modern technological revolution. I mean, between DARPA and Bell Labs alone, you have the development of cellular technology, touchscreen technology, the first transistor, the invention of the internet. It was called DARPANET before it was called the internet. I mean, pick up your smartphone. Everything that you see, everything that you can do with it, had its origins in Bell Labs and DARPA, that only really existed because they didn't have the need to maximize profit on a quarterly basis. They could work and tinker on projects like DARPANET and the transistor for many, many years. And then when those breakthroughs came, when those inventions came, it would often be some other company, like, say, Texas Instruments, that would take the transistor and innovate by finding a commercial application for that innovation and make the transistor radio, something that you would actually sell to a consumer. So I started to go in that digression, but I think it's an important aspect of this piece and a really important part of U.S. technological history to understand that so much of what we have and so much of what we can do is because of companies that never had to make profits, that allowed scientists to tinker and fail, not just for a few months, but for years, maybe even decades, to produce the trunk, the technological trunks from which the innovations that animate our lives are sprouting branches. Now, the second thing that you asked, or the thing that you actually asked before I went into that digression, is can an ordinary company that is funded or not funded by a VC institute some of these policies? The answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes yes, it's important to have a culture that finds ways of evaluating quality without simply evaluating outcomes. That is to say, sometimes in basketball, the announcers or the analysts will say, you have to judge a shot while the ball is in the air, right? You can't say that the shot was stupid to take after you know that it bricked off of the backboard. You have to call the shot while it's in the air before you know the outcome. And this is really difficult to do for employees when you're working on a difficult project, to understand, you know, how do I evaluate this person's smarts, this person's judgment, their fit within the company, if they've only worked on projects that have failed? You know, maybe they're not smart at all. Maybe we should just fire them. But maybe they're brilliant and they've been working on projects that are impossible. And that when we put them on a project that is extremely difficult but not impossible, they'll succeed beyond our wildest dreams. How do we judge the shot while the ball is in the air? And it's there where I think they should take lessons from X in terms of how do you build a work culture that allows for failure and judges the ball at its apex. At the same time, though, to be perfectly honest and perfectly clear, lots of what X does can only be done at a company that has the freedom to lose tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And so I don't think that, you know, companies should simply try to do whatever X is doing, unless, of course, they have millions and millions of dollars of VC help behind them.
Right. So it might be very difficult to perfectly emulate what X is doing, but there are certainly lessons to be drawn there. I'm curious, did you apply after visiting X and talking to the people there? Have you applied any of these own strategies in your own life?
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, in many ways, you know, my work is so different from a tech R&D department. And yet at the same time, I suppose if I abstract the question as broadly as possible, both journalists like me and technologists at X are in the business of looking for new ideas. And there's some research that actually suggests that it's harder to identify new ideas these days for a variety of reasons, some of them very positive, which is that we've already figured out a lot about communications technology or, you know, chemistry, and so it's difficult to have breakthrough ideas in those disciplines, but also because of just competition. So in journalism, you know, to have a scoop, you have to beat out dozens, maybe hundreds of other reporters that are trying to get that scoop. Or if the scoop is more conceptual, if it's an idea, well, then maybe there's dozens or hundreds of people around the world that are trying to sort of have a conceptual breakthrough on the exact same idea. I think the lesson that I've most internalized from my time at X is the importance of diversity in thinking. The way that X sort of institutionalizes diversity is that they have these rapid evaluation teams that try to figure out if new ideas that are introduced to the company are good or bad. So, for example, my article begins with a smattering of scientists from all over the world, particle physicists and a snake roboticist and a bunch of other people in this room evaluating this idea that I pitched to them, which was, should we try to build houses on the ocean because there's a housing crunch in San Francisco? And they had all sorts of fascinating questions and fascinating ways of thinking about the problem of transit and urban sort of residential issues. You know, it occurred to me, and especially as I was talking to Astra Teller, the head of X, that it's so important to have these rapid eval teams come from all over the place, be an across-the-board smattering of intelligences. And I try to simulate that diversity of approach in my writing. I read a lot of fiction. I read a lot of history books, sometimes sort of grand sweeping history books, like, you know, a theory of European development and a history of technology. Sometimes the nonfiction books that I read will have nothing to do with my beat, such as it is. And I actually love that. I love reading a history of how modern roads were built, how concrete was invented and poured, and how bridges were initially built in, say, you know, modern Europe, in thinking about maybe, oh, wait, what if this is a metaphor for some issue that I'm going to write about in the near future? So I'll write down some of the lessons that I might be taking from sort of, you know, infrastructure development in 19th century France. And I never know when that's going to become the perfect lead or the perfect sort of the most important paragraph in an article that I write about the future of cities in a month or a week or a day. And so I try to simulate, as I said, having a room full of weird, off-the-wall, diverse thinkers, but in my head. And the only way to simulate that is by reading history books that have nothing to do with each other and hoping that I can make the connection later.
That's such an important message. And a number of great thinkers throughout history were notorious for doing exactly what you just described. Like Einstein called that combinatory play, where he'd take ideas from different disciplines. He'd play his violin, for example, to when you're stuck in the middle of a problem to decipher the music of the cosmos, if you will. David Bowie was also notorious for taking ideas from different disciplines and combining them into his songs. And that's actually one of the things that I loved about your book, Derek, is the richness of examples that you're able to draw from and the diversity to make the point that you were making. As we were talking before we hit record here, I told Derek that I came across his book at a bookstore in Germany and picked it up and couldn't put it down. And so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the book itself. And I should say to the audience too, even if you're not interested in the subject matter of the book, it's just so well written that you're going to be captivated no matter what. So I highly encourage you to check it out. But Derek, what's the big idea in the book?
So the big idea of Hitmakers, the big question of Hitmakers is, why do we like what we like? Why do some ideas and cultural products become popular while similar ideas and cultural products fail to capture an audience? And I would say that the book has two theses, two myths that it essentially tries to bust. The first is the myth of novelty, and the second is the myth of virality. The myth of novelty, that there's an idea in modern culture that consumers are entranced by shiny new objects. We want new clothes and hear and want to listen to new songs. We want to watch new movies. We want access to new ideas and new podcasts, et cetera, et cetera. But the most fundamental finding in the history of psychology is this idea called the mere exposure effect. And the mere exposure effect says that the mere exposure of any idea to you will over time bias you toward that idea. In short, we have a familiarity bias, not a novelty bias, a familiarity bias. 90% of the time we're listening to music, we're listening to a song that we've already heard. Every year this century, a majority of the top 10 movies in the U.S. have been sequels, adaptations, and reboots. Familiar, familiar, familiar. I think this is true in industrial design, in product design, in tech design, even in journalism. We find all the time that the articles that people are most likely to share online aren't articles about entirely new concepts, but rather articles that very beautifully illustrate or crystallize ideas or biases that the sharer had already intuited. And so throughout the book, I'm constantly dealing with this struggle that, you know, hit makers need to produce new products, but they need to produce products that are sneakily familiar. And I come up with this idea, or I share this idea, that the father of industrial design, Raymond Loewy, once called Maya. He said, great products should be Maya, most advanced yet acceptable. They should be familiar surprises, new ideas that sneakily introduce us or sneakily open a door so that we discover familiarity inside of them. And I apply this idea throughout the book very liberally to music and technology, and even to identity in things like how we choose first names for our babies. The second big idea from the book is the myth of virality. There's this idea, I think, in modern culture, again, that when a product sort of takes off, an idea takes off really quickly and we don't know how, we sometimes default to saying, oh, it went viral. In epidemiology, virality means something pretty specific. It means that a disease spreads through many, many generations of intimate sharing. I get you sick, you get two other people sick, they get four other people sick, and the disease sort of forks outward. But in information, there's another way that information can spread, and that's through a broadcast. Not a million one-to-one moments, but one one-to-1 million moment. And without going on too deeply, basically, I'll say that when data scientists have studied the spread of online content that would seem to be viral, they discovered that the map of that idea catching on, that YouTube video or Facebook article catching on, much more likely resembles a series of diffuse broadcasts, a lot of bursts, a lot of explosions, not a pure virus. And this idea that even online, popularity is dictated by the biggest broadcast turns out to be a really, really powerful idea for explaining how concepts catch on even sneakily and sometimes even darkly on the internet. And I talk about that application, both for understanding popularity on the internet and for marketing.
And as you were writing this book about hitmakers, did you think about applying any of the strategies that you're writing about to actually make the book a hit?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, you know, there's a line in the book. I think it's the most underlined line on Kindle, on the Kindle version of the book. And it's to sell something familiar, make it surprising. But to sell something surprising, make it familiar. That is, in order to produce familiar surprises, you have to understand which part of the map you're starting with. Are you trying to sell something that is going to shock your audience? Or are you trying to sell something that your audience will relatively intuit? If you're trying to sell something that your audience already gets, if you're essentially just, you know, repackaging conventional wisdom, or, you know, telling your audience that the CW is correct, but trying to put a new spin on it, then your challenge is, okay, how do I, you know, find new stories to animate this idea? So there's lots and lots of books, lots of self-help books, I should say, and I don't consider my book purely a self-help book, but there's lots of self-help books that essentially take axioms that everyone kind of knows, that everyone's mom, maybe dad, you know, told them 1,000 times and says, you know, here's a new way to think about it. Here's a new story to animate this conventional wisdom. What I try to do in this book is provide some surprising viewpoints or tell some surprising stories. And so the challenge was always for me, how do I take this conclusion from psychology or this story from data science and make it understandable so that people can quote it, so that people can close the book and immediately turn to their partner in bed or their friend in the subway and say, I remember what the takeaway is from this and I want to talk about it. Making the complex simple. That was the goal of this book. And so in many ways, yeah, I tried to make the book Maya by finding ways to take the surprising and make it feel familiar.
And I think you've succeeded in that just because I was at a party a week or two ago when we were talking about why Hamilton turned out to be such a big hit. And I actually ended up citing your book saying that, you know, this puts a new costume on an old story. It's the story of a, you know, young, scrappy, hungry founding father, but on the modern Broadway stage. Same thing with the show Americans, which my wife and I love. Mm-hmm. It's about this old story, a dysfunctional marriage, but told through the lens of Russian spies.
Oh, yeah. I think the Americans is a great example. I think FX actually does a wonderful job at telling old stories in new ways. The Americans, in many ways, is a marriage drama. It's about how well do you know your partner? Where does intimacy come from? How do relationships grow? These are really, really old questions. There have been a million romances written going back to, you know, Greek drama about these questions. But The Americans has a really clever take on it, which is sometimes it feels like you don't know your spouse or it feels like you're in cahoots. Well, imagine if we took that to its most dramatic extension and said that you and your spouse were both spies and that you had to keep this a secret from all the closest people in your life. A brilliant twist on a very familiar storyline.
What was the process of writing the book like compared to writing articles for The Atlantic?
When I started writing for The Atlantic, I was writing mostly blog posts. And a blog post is kind of like shopping for a shirt. If you find the right graph or the right statistic or you come up with the right one-sentence frame, that's it. You can write your blog post. And then I started writing columns and features for The Atlantic, and I realized that writing a feature for The Atlantic, like the Google X piece, is a little bit more like organizing a closet. the experience of writing a piece like that actually doesn't even, from a temporal standpoint, feel like writing. It feels more like organizing already written thoughts. How do I make the tempo of these ideas feel like it makes sense, feel natural to a first-time reader? And that's an organizational challenge, principally. Writing a book isn't like organizing a closet. It's like organizing a house. It's like you bought this house and it's filled with empty rooms, and every empty room is the possibility of a space, but you have to buy the couches and the shirts and the televisions and the bed and the wallpaper and have to figure out where everything goes. And so it's an organizational challenge on steroids. And, you know, looking back, this is my first book. I think there are parts of the book where I'm so happy at how I succeeded, and parts of the book where I'm like, oh, I'm now, okay, now I know how to improve on this in my future book. That organizational challenge is really, really difficult, because these ideas that I'm presenting, or the ideas in any book, don't necessarily know that they belong between the same, like in the same binding. They don't know that they belong together. And so you have to figure out, what's the through line here? What's the line that I can draw that connects these ideas in such a way that it is both true and entertaining? And so I think the longer the writing project becomes, the more the substance of the challenge becomes less about writing and more about organization.
That really resonates with me, because I'm right now just knee deep in writing a book, and I find myself carrying this like really heavy flat screen TV from the living room and telling myself, yeah, well, maybe it, you know, really belongs in the bedroom. And then I, 2 days later, I pick it up from the bedroom and put it into the office, and then back to the bedroom, and then back to the living room.
I'm familiar with this game of musical televisions.
Well, Derek, this was so much fun. You've given us not only just great stories and anecdotes to ponder about failure, but great mantras as well. I actually wrote two of these on a post-it note. One is 9 a.m. frame of mind, and the other is Shakespeare first. These are, I think, great shorthands for some of the principles that you discuss. But before we part ways, I want to give you the opportunity, one, to share any parting words you might have with the audience, anything that we should have discussed but did not get around to discussing. And second, please also tell us where people can find you online.
I suppose I'll just say this. I'm constantly trying to formalize my own thinking about writing and about coming up with ideas and expressing ideas. And the most recent formalization of that thinking is a little quip that goes like this: learning is accumulation and understanding is elimination. That in the process of understanding a topic, understanding a philosophy, writing a book, presenting a memo, you have to learn all this stuff. You have to be an open sieve. You have to have thin skin and let everything permeate. But when it comes to the work of expressing those ideas for an audience, it's actually about knowing not really what to put in, but what to leave out. Because 95% of what you've accumulated has to be left out for the work to make any sense or for it to be consumable. And that's the work of elimination. And so my job and your job and anyone whose job is a knowledge-based job, I think, has the same challenge. How do you know when to accumulate, and how do you know when to stop and eliminate? Because the latter, I think, is what makes a product consumable.
Absolutely. And it's not easy, especially when you develop emotional attachment to what you have accumulated, either by way of knowledge or by way of writing. And so killing your darlings, as Stephen King put it, is not easy, but it's essential work.
Yeah. And then where can people find me? They can find me on The Atlantic. They can find me on Twitter at DK Thomp. They can buy the book Hitmakers. They can listen or subscribe to the podcast Crazy Genius, which is about big questions and provocative conclusions in technology and science. And then if they like NPR, they can listen to me every Monday on Here and Now, where I'm a news analyst.
Thank you so much, Derek.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.